Guardian, the Federal Reserve was hit with more than 50 successful cyber attacks in a 5-year span, which cost them 21 million background check records being stolen. And while it may be common for attackers to go for a low risk, high reward target, in the same article, the cyber team tasked with protecting the Federal Reserve stated that they were targeted by attackers just as often as other financial institutions. And these are just two examples of roughly 443 agencies which help keep our country functioning to the capacity that we utilize daily. Next is the local system. So our local systems could include emergency services, colleges, utilities like sewer and water, and more. One example of cyber threats affecting these areas I've actually experienced firsthand. So a college which I applied to over 13 years ago, mind you, had a data breach. I applied to the college I never attended, but they still had all of my information on file in a database somewhere, which was compromised by an attacker. So while this incident is relatively mild compared to incidents that could occur to hospitals or emergency services, it's important to understand that information should be guarded and managed properly, because this can affect individuals far beyond in the future, like me, 13 years. Who would have thought? And this brings us into businesses. So when I first started at Purdue, I was working for an organization which touts itself as the happiest place on earth. And looking around at their systems and networks, which they use for rides and operations, there were actually multiple network SSIDs which were left visible to the public. These networks controlled systems that operate live shows and even some new and automated attractions. Now, it might not seem like a big deal, and some people might say, what's the worst you could do? Ruin a kid's day by taking down a show or a ride? But the reality is that these systems could cause serious injury or worse to those on the ride or nearby. Some of these networks control automated systems which move large and heavy objects and scenic pieces. Safety mechanisms which monitor for faults that would otherwise prevent an accident from occurring. And yes, it probably would ruin that kid's day and his parents after they spend $150 per ticket. But on a little bit of a lighter note, and to ease your minds when you do go to the park, the SSIDs that were visible to the public are very hardened and they monitor those networks very closely, I can assure you that. But just thinking about the implications of these networks being compromised made me realize something, which is that in a place where happiness is the motto, threats and vulnerabilities exist and need to be managed accordingly. Well, what about individuals? After coming to the realization how this field of cybersecurity is critical, even in what may seemingly be the most innocent place on earth, I decided to look inward at myself and what my cyber posture was and how I could better protect myself from being the victim of an attack. The first step was gaining the knowledge about the various types of attacks used to steal information. These attacks range from phishing campaigns, social engineering, viruses, malware, and many, many more. Purdue Global and the program, especially the internship program, have helped me prevent, well, me and my wife actually, from being or falling victim to suspicious content. We actually got a letter which stated that it was from the IRS that we were subject to get money back. It turns out it was a fraud. I looked up the address that was on the email and it was in the middle of nowhere somewhere. So it's important to ensure authenticity with everything you do. Security alerts with individuals and, oh, sorry, I lost my place here. Oh, security starts with individuals, and the more someone knows about an adversary, whether it's federal, local, business, or just to protect themselves, the better the odds they have at actually not falling victim to an attack. So, who is cybersecurity for? I think the best answer for this question is actually that cybersecurity is for everyone. We live in an age of technology where there's no going back and only forward. So the better we can prepare ourselves for the risks involved in that, the better off we'll all be. And that's it for me.
All right, thank you. And yes, I do have questions, and hopefully you'll stick around till the end
I will
because,
be here.
all right, thank you. And so next up, we have, don't want dark mode, Shane Folkerts. Are you ready, Shane?
Yeah.
All right,
Can
take it
you
away.
see my screen all right and hear me? Right, so my presentation is on how firewall works, and I have a little demo after I talk about how firewalls work, and then we'll go into two different types of firewalls. So the main functions of firewalls are mainly to block unauthorized traffic. This acts as like a 24/7 filter that blocks anything suspicious. You want to allow anything that is a business need and block anything else. Stuff that could be suspicious is like scanning like Nmap. I know in the cybersecurity chat, Sean asked a question about how do we bypass firewalls with Nmap scanning. And so, that's just another, deterrent or way to mitigate some attacks by having a firewall in place so that, that makes it harder for attackers to see what's on the network. Firewalls can also route traffic. They can do layer three routing, such as like static routes, some dynamic routing protocols like OSPF and BGP. They can also do network access translation or NAT, which takes a private IP space and can change it into a different IP, such as a public IP for internet access. So one of the ways that this can be utilized today is like changing from IPv4 address to IPv6 if you only have a couple IPv6, or sometimes I've seen in the networking field it's hard to migrate to IPv6, so this is a good way of doing so. Firewalls also are good at utilizing VPNs. For example, at work I use site-to-site VPNs, which primarily we use IPsec, and client VPNs for users to connect from remotely to connect to resources they need at the company. And then also, almost all firewalls can detect the state of connections that are going outbound and inbound. This is called a stateful firewall. It has a state table that watches all the connections going in and out of the firewall. And if they are established by a trusted source, then they'll allow that traffic coming back in. And a non-stateful firewall, you would have to allow that traffic back in as like another rule on the firewall. So stateful can be helpful so you don't have twice as many access controls. Before we go into much more, I kind of wanted to touch on the OSI model so everyone's on the same page about what I'm talking about. The first layer is like your mode of connection, like fiber or Ethernet, kind of how the data flows. Second layer is like your MAC address that you get. Most of this is just local traffic on the network. And then layer three is where you get your IP address and you can go across different networks. Layer four is where the TCP and UDP come into play. And then session five and six. Session five is responsible for maintaining ports and sessions on the host and server side. And then the main one, and then the last layer is layer seven, which is what kind of human computer interaction, where kind of how we see like the web page pop up, things like that. That will kind of help in what I'm about to talk about next. So today we're going to be looking at two different firewalls. There are many different brands, but today I have a Cisco ASA and a Palo Alto firewall with me, and so we're going to do a little demo. So I just want to talk about the differences and how they come into play. So a Cisco ASA is mostly layer 3 and layer 4. It looks at the source and destination address and also the ports, and can also do TCP inspection. So you can see I kind of have a layout of different things that the ASA can inspect. DNS, FTP, NetBIOS, and some others. And this can, in my opinion, this kind of hurts more than helps, because if you're not following, if the application's not following the same rules as what the firewall is looking for, it's going to drop that traffic. And then moving on to the Palo Alto, this is called a next-gen firewall. You probably heard that term. Next-gen firewall means that, you know, it takes that, it can do application inspection and do some like threat protection stuff as well. So this can look at layer 7 as the traffic's flowing through the firewall. It can detect what application the user and server are negotiating on. And, you know, last time I looked at this, there's close to 1,000 different applications that the Palo Alto has, and they have like a whole kind of like wiki on their different applications to decide which one you want to use. I'll kind of show you that in the demo later. And then also can do threat protection stuff like preventing DDoS attacks, flooding, which is pretty much the same, but you just send a bunch of packets to the network to try and kind of take it down or crash the system. And then it can also do SSL decryption, which you utilize certs on the host to basically use the Palo Alto as kind of like a SSL proxy so that it can decrypt the web traffic so that the Palo Alto can do some deep packet inspection on HTTPS traffic as well. So here's kind of a flow diagram of how packets come in. So it kind of shows how firewalls kind of watch the traffic as it flows through the interfaces. So here's kind of an example. So you have like an internal user trying to connect to like a web server. And so it the packet comes into an interface. It looks for existing connection in the state table. If that doesn't exist, then it looks at the routing table and says, do I have this destination? No, then I'll drop it. If it does have a destination, then does it have an access rule that will allow it through? Yes, then keep going. And then NAT rules, you know, is this translated to a different IP address? And then moves on to layer 7 inspection. And if it meets all those requirements, it will allow it through the firewall. And if any of those fail, then it will drop the packet. So here's our kind of diagram that I'm going to be working through in the demo. So I just have a simple like internal client network, and they need to reach the DMZ where the web server is hosted. They need to have okay. So for our access rules, they need to have web access to the web server, and then also management over RDP so that they can manage the web server. The difference between Palo Alto and ASA is that Palo Alto uses zones to determine kind of the source and destination. So Palo Alto will have, so there's different interfaces, and then you can tag them with security zones is what they call it. And so our different networks are going to be the DMZ internal and then the untrusted outside source. The ASA mostly uses interfaces. You can use zones, but you'll see later how the access lists are actually tied to the interface. So I'm going to go into our Palo Alto and we can start our little demo here. So the Palo Alto, I'm going to be using the GUI. I found that this is the best way to manage Palo Alto. And then Cisco ASA, there is a GUI tool to use, but I found that because it's kind of Java-based, it can be a little buggy at times. So CLI is best for that one. So I'm going to start off with our network tab and take a look at our interfaces here. So I have our DMZ network, and then our outside untrusted source and our internal. I just kind of have some random networks that I made that matches our diagram. And then, so as we can see, the DMZ source, DMZ interface has a security zone of DMZ. And so this is how you can create a zone to drop these interfaces in. And I'll show you how we apply these in a minute here. So then if we come into our zone protection here, we can tie these kind of threat protection into our zones. So we can do flood protection with UDP, SYN attacks, you know, ICMP, you know, just ways that attackers can attack your network. You know, like host sweeps or port scans, we can alert on those and take action based on the thresholds that we have here, which is an interval of 2 seconds and things like that. So now moving in. So then layer three routing, kind of wanted to show you that too. So we can have OSPF, BGP, RIP, and then we have like our static routes that we can determine the interface to go out and configure that for layer three routing. And now, so I'm just going to walk you through, like, if we were going to allow our, come back to here quick so we can see the diagram again. So if we're going to allow from our internal to our DMZ zones for these different ports, I kind of had this set up so we kind of walked through it. So if we wanted to take a look at like our web browsing, is this big enough for everyone can see? It's a little small on my screen. I don't know if I can.
It's pretty small, but I can kind of see it.
Is that a little bit easier?
Oh yeah, that's easier.
Okay. So if we come in, our source zone will be from our internal client source, and then our source network of 10.10.10.0. So we choose our zone. That's where our zone plays in. And then if we go to our destination, we would choose our DMZ zone for the web traffic, which is on the 10.20.20 network. And then our application rules are here so that we can add. So where you'd look this up, if we didn't know what applications to use. Second here, I had it. We can look up like TCP. That's really small. Sorry, just bear with me. Maybe. Let me just try SSL. So we were type in SSL and then come down here. We can see that SSL means port 443. And so this is the kind of the application wiki that I was talking about, how you can type in like ports and it will come back with the application that you want to filter on. So based on that, we would come back here and put in SSL. And then I know from my work that it's web browsing for port 80. So once we put that in, you can also do services as well. You could do TCP port 80 here, and it will, but for most things, the application default, like we saw back here, is port 443. So it already applies the port side of things. So as long as you have the application in, it'll match the port in most cases. There's a few things where that does not apply, but for most part, you can leave this as default. And then the same thing with like our RDP session. So we have source internal from our client side network to our destination DMZ. And then application, if we didn't know what that was, let's just say, yeah, we want RDP. And then we come down here and we're like, oh, it's a Microsoft server, so we need MS RDP. And so that allows our TCP 3389 and UDP 3389. And that will allow it there. Another thing, if you're like, I really don't know the application, I have one for my management, how I'm getting to the Palo Alto right now. And it has a cool feature, and you can look and see the application scene. So on this rule, it's gotten three different applications. And there's SSL, which is our 443, our web browsing, which is port 80. And I also was pinging this appliance earlier. So you can tell here that it's using these applications, where I can go ahead and add this to the rule, and it will apply the applications right there. And so sometimes if you don't know what to allow through the firewall, you can add a blank rule, lots of traffic for a little bit, and then it'll tell you what applications, you know, this web server is using, and you can add them manually. To go into some other things, I had some rules here. So like the client VPN side of things, Palo Alto has what's called Glower Protect, and this is kind of what it looks like. So you have like authentication server and authorization server. And once you connect with the username, password, and hopefully MFA, you get connected to the network. There's also IPsec tunnels that you can create. I didn't have enough time to set that up, but I'll show you in the other firewall when we have a moment. And then the cool thing about Palo Alto is the monitor tab. You can see all the traffic that goes through the firewall, and you can see what zone it's coming from, where it's going to, the application that it's using, is allowed or not. So it's just the state of the session. And so it tells you a lot of information, and you can dive deeper into it with the packet capture, and you can download that and view it in Wireshark later if need be. And that's pretty much all I wanted to touch on with the Palo Alto, and I'll show you the ASA now. Let me make this a little bit bigger. Can everyone see the text?
Pretty small.
If not, I can make it a little bit bigger.
Oh, I'm on my laptop, so that might be why.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to show you kind of the same thing. So we have our different interfaces built out. And the thing with Cisco ASA is that they have these security levels, which kind of act as kind of access control. So the higher the security level is, the higher the kind of access control that you want. So it blocks everything from a lower security level. So our untrusted source will have zero, and that means it can't go anywhere into our network. It can't go any higher than zero. Anything above that, like our internal by default can get to the DMZ because it's a lower level, and it can go to the untrust environment. But you can bypass this rule by making access controlless, which I'll show you right now. One second. So our same rules, but in text form that we saw earlier, and kind of not as fancy with the applications. So we have our internal rules. So we have our internal network. We're permitting our TCP connection from our internal network to our DMZ network for port 80, which is classified as www for Cisco, they change it, and HTTPS, which is port 443. And then our RDP session for 3389. And then, so that's tied to the internal interface. And then we also have to have a DMZ interface with the same rules, because that'll apply to our DMZ interface. It gets kind of confusing, depending on, you know, how you look at your interfaces and stuff, especially in a large environment when you may have multiple VLANs connected to and multiple networks connected to your firewalls, and there's a ton of rules. And so you kind of have to be aware of, you know, how it lives on the network. And that's kind of where the routing table comes in, because you can really take a look at the routing table, see which interface, what routes go where, and you can kind of track it that way as well. There's a cool, you can just do show IP, and it will show each interface and what, you know, what's the name, what subnet it's associated with, and then to tie the access list to an interface, it's called an access group, and that access group ties it to the interface. So you have your DMZ out, and it's going outbound from the firewall perspective to the web server on interface DMZ, and then we tie our internal access group to inward bound traffic from our client network to the firewall. So you kind of have to think about how the firewall sits on the network too, so it gets confusing. And tie that to the interface internal. And so that's why I kind of want to show you the Palo Alto side of things first, so you kind of get a grasp of how it works, because the ASA is a lot less user-friendly to jump in and kind of see what's going on. So then from there, you know, you don't have your GUI looking at all the traffic, so you have to do like a capture. You can pull a capture on any data that you want to look at. So here I have a capture on any IP protocol from our internal network to our external network, and that will do a packet capture, and you can download that and look that in Wireshark and analyze it further. I had some NAT rules set up, but I know unless you work with firewalls, you won't get it. It's, you know, just taking from the internal to untrust so I can get out to the internet. And then I also had a IPsec tunnel kind of built out with AES 256 and SHA 256 as well. And then you have phase one, which is IKE2, and has their encryption integrity and kind of how it builds the tunnel. And then it takes that and uses that to make an IPsec tunnel with these encryption standards. Then you have like where you want the flow or a tunnel with the access list and the peer and stuff. I just kind of want to touch a high level on the two firewalls. I don't want to go too deep with, you know, it gets confusing real fast, even for me sometimes, as doing this for 5 years. Yeah, if you have questions at the end, I can pull these back up and we can look at it. But that was all I had for now. So thank you.
Thanks, Shane. That was great. Wow. I learned a lot and I do have questions. All right. Who do we have next? Steven, are you ready to go?
Yep, I'm here.
All right. Go ahead and take it away.
All right. So I kind of deviated from networking and all that stuff and went a different route to something that's new to me within the last 30 days because of my new job. So I deal with the intermodal transportation industry now after being in a tech support role for a GPS tracking company for the past 18 years. So this kind of piqued my interest and just wanted to explore it a little bit. A little background information on intermodal, and it refers to the movement of freight by two or more modes of transportation, and it falls into two different categories, either international and domestic, where domestic is just in the North America, and the international intermodal shipments is usually on a container that is 20 feet or 40 feet in length, while domestic containers are 53 foot, just like a 53 foot trailer on the expressways in the U.S. And the reason for them being 20 or 40 foot containers for intermodal is that 20 and 40, they go into what's called a 20 foot equivalent unit that is used by the steamship carriers that haul the cargo from overseas to the U.S. and it just fits on them better. For shipment visibility in the intermodal industry, they really don't provide visibility to see where the chassis and containers are, and that's where the technology part comes into play. I found out that they use an EDI, which is electronic data interchange, to send that information from the depots to the carriers, and it's a standardized format for the interchange of that data. And then my wheelhouse is GPS tracking, and that is one portion of technology that they use heavily now. They're becoming more dependent on it, and instead of seeing it like a luxury item, it's kind of like a business necessity. So the electronic data interchange, like I said, it is the exchange of information from one computer system to another using the standardized business communication, just kind of like all the other standardized information in IT. Then the GPS technology that's used, it helps them to know the locations of the containers and the chassis when they start and stop, and then when they also open a door or close a door. And then the other important piece of information is to know when a container is loaded on or off what's called the chassis. And the importance of that is to help them know where the shipment is in the journey, and then also understand how the fleet is being utilized, and then any inventory that is hanging out in the storage yards. And then a big item is the recovery of chassis or containers in case of theft. As you can imagine, there's hundreds of thousands of chassis throughout the U.S., and they go missing in action, and someone needs to find them, and it's really hard to find them when you don't have GPS on them. So that's really about all I have.
I found this very interesting. My husband's a truck driver, so yeah, GPS.
Tracking. That's right.
Yep. We use that. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Nick, should be up next, but I'm not seeing him in.
I'm here.
Oh, you're here?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I must be hidden. I don't know how I'm going to follow those three. I mean,
it's not, Nick not... on the other thing.
they didn't set the stage easy for me, guys. But
do you prefer Nick or Nicholas?
Nick.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Go ahead. Take it away.
All right. So my presentation is going to be on NIST compliance and audit basics. Who and what is NIST? NIST is National Institute of Standard and Technology. I've got a link there. They founded in 1901. They're a government entity under the U.S. Department of Commerce. They're actually one of the oldest science laboratories in the United States. And other than cybersecurity framework that I'm going to go over, they also set standards and critical measurement solutions, help work and promote equitable standards for many different industries. A little bit more about the NIST cybersecurity framework. Cybersecurity framework is considered the NIST 800-171 cybersecurity standard. It's noted by ISO ISE 2700:2018 standard as being the standard in cybersecurity frameworks. It's not required for government contracts or anything like that per se, but I have learned through working with a lot of my clients that being NIST compliant is not only great to show stakeholders, help get potential partners, help attain government contracts. I actually have worked with one of my clients. They work with the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard basically was like, we want to continue working with you guys, but we're going to give you basically 3 years to become NIST compliant. We're going to do our own, audit on you guys in 3 years. We understand, thrown up. So they actually came to us. We're doing their third party NIST audit, because apparently that's the way a lot of the government entities are going. They are wanting it, but they understand a lot of companies don't have it from the get go, but it does help. And another thing is it does long-term stress relief. Now you'll notice as I go through, the organization and the information that I show as those going through the cybersecurity program, that if you look at this, you go, oh, as my company has all this laid out, we have all this in order, or you'd like, knowing what to have in order, this really helps your job and helps along the way to make sure that your company's not only compliant, but helps keep the cybersecurity and the company in general in good standing, just a good cybersecurity posture in general. So starting off with the basics of the framework. Starts with the function, identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover. Those are the five main functions, and then it goes down into subcategories from there. So then identify, you have your asset management, business environment, governance. I won't go through all these and bore you guys with all this. But as you can tell, they all have their own ID. The ID is used, obviously it's just shorthand for identify, governance, IDGV. As you're going through, and again, I'll go into the subcategories and things like that. And as policies and everything are going in place, this really helps to identify, because there is a lot of crossover between a lot of these items. A lot of policies, procedures, things like that might cover, something that's in governance might also cover part of the response planning and the communications. Those all might lay into one policy. So having those short hand items there make it a lot easier to keep track of everything. So further branching into it, as we dig in, so each one of these has a subcategory as well. So you go into the business environment and it'll dig even deeper. So as you're going through an audit, whether it's your company again or auditing another company, So in order to go through the business environment, you'll go into the subcategories. Again, organization's role in supply chain is identified and communicated. So that's just going to be one subcategory. And I'm going to put in the CyberWiki. I don't believe I saw it there. I actually have a full spreadsheet of basically a framework for the audit with the information that has all of this. Basically dug all the way down. On the next slide, you'll see a little bit of it. Because of the way it digs down, it really helps to kind of go through and check stuff off as a basic. But it does work hand in hand. NIST works hand in hand with COBIT 5. And again, with ISO, IEC, this shows 2013. 2018 is the newest, but a lot of times you'll still see 2013 on a lot of the documentation you can find. And then it goes through the SP-53 revisions as well. So you can actually go and reference all of these to connect with these and give you more information. So say you kind of don't like the way this is, you kind of go, what could it correlate to? Or say you work with a client, they go, well, we've been doing COBIT, or we've been trying to go off the 53 standard. You can go back and go through all that and go, well, this is what correlates to that in there. So you can pull that over, pull it out of what they have currently in their binder for their COBIT and say, okay, you do have that in place. So when you're testing and verifying each control, you'll go through those. So again, and I'm going to put this in the CyberWiki for everybody. So you have your control, which again is the physical devices and systems, and organization are inventoried. So that's asset management. And then it goes down to control objective for that, down to your controls. And then, so this actually gives you the testing steps. So as you're going through, this tells you how you can verify that this control, where they're at in this control as far as implementation. Obtain a copy of the devices and systems inventory, review the inventory considering the following, go through the scope of the devices. And again, I'm not going to read through all this and bore you guys. I almost thought about going through the whole thing, but I didn't want to take up an entire hour. But as you can see, as you go through these, a lot of these, and again, you have software platforms and applications in the organization are inventoried. And this just digs down deeper, gives a lot of times, of course, that you'll go through these and you'll want to figure out a way to organize all this. So the way I actually organize this is I use Monday boards. If you don't use Monday boards, you haven't used Monday boards, I love them. It's phenomenal. So again, you look back and you go with that physical devices and systems that are in the organization or inventory, not implemented, partially implemented. So as you're looking at this, you want to go through the assess state and the target state for your client or your company. So the assess state is going to be, where are they in this? So there's in NIST really has four levels, and you can, they, depending on where you look at NIST themselves throughout their website, kind of has different ways of basically putting it. So there's not implemented, partially implemented, largely implemented, fully implemented. So it's whether the, how far along. So if they have, and as you can tell from the slide before, there's a lot of items for each one. So say they have, one or two of these, they might be partially implemented. So let's say they have three of the four items for this category, largely implemented. And then if they have all of it completed and they have all the documentation evidence for it, fully completed. And then there's also target state. So a lot of companies, again, there's a lot of items as you go through all of these. Not every company will actually have correlation to it. Not all of them will have actually have that item to go. It'll be null. It's not implemented. So you might have something that's not implemented at all that's not going to be implemented because they don't use, not really going to do it here, but supply chain risk management. So, like I said, a lot of places everywhere should have supply chain risk management if you dig down deep enough. But if a company didn't have any supply chain, then they'd be not implemented and they wouldn't need to be in their target state. Based on the company, again, you don't have to be completely compliant for everything to be considered NIST compliant. It just has to be what's compliant for your business. They understand that it's a huge compliance. They're not going to dig down and have individual for each individual company to say your organization needs to be this to be NIST compliant. It's really up to the auditors to understand to go through that, which is why, of course, there are certifications for this kind of thing. I am not certified, but I'm definitely looking to go through get quite a few of my compliance certifications. Again, in Monday boards, as you go through and you put that, have these, you know, partially implemented, largely implemented, you can put the evidence in a slot, make sure there's always evidence, and then notes to take as far as where they could be and where they go, is how I tend to work mine. So then once you go through those, you go to the policies and procedures organizing the auditing process. So again, here's all of those prefixes and stuff for the, for all their numbering, lettering, so you know what they apply to. So the cyber incident response standard that a company may need to have applies to each one of these buckets. So when you go back into the audit, you say, okay, you know, it applies, because the biggest thing you'll look at is it's redundancy. It looks like you have a million things to do. Really, you only have about 500,000 because of all the stuff that goes through. What I like to do is, again, I use the Monday boards, and I will put in a policy template. Again, a lot of the with my ISACA membership, you can find a lot of policy templates and stuff like that. I know a lot of the organizations that you can be a part of and join also will have those for free, policy templates, things like that. Or if you pay for any sort of the NIST audit programs, there's a lot of programs out there to help kind of organize and automate this process. Monday boards is just a much cheaper option. And I like to organize things and create them my way. So as you're looking at this, you put your policy in here. The client will go through the policy and edit the template so that it fits their company. And then what myself and my company likes to do is we go through their edits and look at it and kind of go over with them and say, okay, we see you made this change, this change, this change. We also think that you should implement this, or maybe you want to, you know, add in, you know, something else to go with it. That way it gets compliant. And then at the end of the day, all of these get put back into their evidence bucket. The target state gets changed. And again, that goes all the way down through all of the sub items and items. And then once they have all this completed and where they need to be, all that goes into, again, we always, you know, have people have hard copies. You want to have some sort of binder with your compliance in it. And then, of course, you have your hard copies. And that gives you the goals, of course, what you want to look into, what you want to go towards. And then you set a timeline of saying, okay, we need to take care of this. We need to get these policies taken care of. And once you know what you need, your team knows what needs to be done, what to focus on. And then once you're actually compliant, it's just a matter of maintaining that, maintaining your logs, maintaining making sure that you have all of your standards in place, that you have your communication and response, you know, stuff updated as your company grows, things like that. So it really is a great, I'm going to say a great starting point, but it's a great midway point to go from where you start to where you need to be, and then maintaining that as a company. So again, I've done quite a few of these NIST audits through a lot of clients. And honestly, I wish we learned more about it within our classes and things like that, as far as the auditing phases, things like that, and just how easy being NIST compliant or even COVID compliant, but having the compliance standards in place can make it for a company. And that's all I have.
Thanks. That was great. Wow. That was very in-depth.
I just tried to skim over the top as much as possible, to be honest with you. I could have made that an hour or two, but
I'm below novice level when it comes to this stuff. So thank you. That was great. Jason, are you ready? Jason Anderson? All right. Can see your screen.
Yep.
All right. Take it away.
So I'm going to go over launching a Windows Server 22 Elastic Compute Cloud instance. My screen back up here. There we go. So first, you know, what is an Amazon Elastic Compute Cloud? Amazon EC2 is a web service that provides secure, resizable compute capacity in the cloud. The service provides a reliable, scalable infrastructure on demand in a variety of operating systems, such as Windows or Linux, or there's a whole Amazon web service marketplace full of different AMIs, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But basically, AWS boasts around the security of being built into the foundation of the EC2 with the AWS Nitro system. Its flexible operations allow clients to make decisions and performance and cost in mind, all while optimizing their performance. Why choose an EC2 instance? Amazon EC2 offers a low-cost ability to host a variety of web apps, gaming, researching, entertainment, and marketing services. One of the more common uses for an EC2 instance is for hosting anything from applications to software and websites. The best part is that the compute capacity is entirely scalable so that it can grow with the needs of the applications. Scalability is providing an ability to quality service for all end users at all times. Companies like Netflix and Reddit are proof of this concept. This also means that companies can spin up large testing environments relatively easy. This is made possible by removing the upfront cost for hardware. EC2 can be used as a medium for performing disaster recovery. The Elastic Compute Cloud can be spun up in a very short time, allowing businesses to have faster failover and minimize the downtime. High performance computing is on the rise, and EC2 is equipped to provide specialized virtualized servers that provide both high performance networking and compute power. This is useful for big data analytics tasks, such as like Pfizer and NASA are both using EC2 for the high performance computing capacities. So when launching the EC2 instance, start with initiating the instance launch by going to the it's the dashboard, and then you go to services, and then EC2 with an instance launch. So after that, you're going to choose an AMI, which are procured through the AWS marketplace. This is an online store where you can essentially just buy software to run on EC2 instances. Next, you're going to choose that an instance type. This is usually referred to as the tier, one of the free tiers, tier 2 micro. If any instance is labeled free tier, obviously it's free. Make changes to the settings if necessary, number of instances, optional scaling group, network settings. Next would be adding the storage, which is pretty straightforward. AMIs allow you to select what storage, whether you want one or more storage volumes. Next would be adding tags for security groups. Then you're going to configure the security group to define firewall rules for the instance and other security settings. And then last, you'll review the launch settings and then launch for the P pair. So I am going to go through that now. And this is, for those of you who haven't seen it, all the services that AWS offers. And initially, you would want to look for VPC. This is the virtual private cloud, and to review your networking configurations. In here is where you can see your subnets, your gateways, anything routing related that you would need for setting up your instances. From there, since I've already been here, going to EC2. Go to launch instance. You can just launch on plane, which is what we're going to do, or you can launch an instance from a template that you have created. So let's go to launch instance. We're going to name this PGP test server 1. And like I said, we're going to choose a Windows server. This is where you can go into, look for more different AMIs and choose Linux, Mac, a wide variety of different types of whatever. But for this instance, I'm going to use a Windows free tier. And we're going to choose a free tier instance type. So I have a key pair login made, but I'm going to go ahead and make one with this purpose. EKP, and we'll download that. Next, again, you'll look at your network settings. choose a security group. I'm going to choose one that's already pre-existing, and that should be this launch wizard. You can configure your storage. 130 gigabytes will be fine for this, and one instance is set up there. You hit launch, you do all instances, and our PGIP test server is currently spinning up. We'll wait a few minutes and let that load. All right, it is up now. We can connect. It's a Windows, so I can use RDP. And I have to get the password. In a moment, I can get the password. Global key pair open. So that's that key pair. I'll decrypt it and give me the password to log in. RDP. Oh no. Password. There we go. And this is our brand new Windows Server 22 EC2 instance. If you've ever used Windows before, you know it takes a moment for it to set up. And from here, you can anything you could do on a physical server. Disconnect. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you. Okay. I will open up the floor to questions. Felicia, you have your hand raised. Did you want to ask the first question? We can't hear you, Felicia. Are you double muted? Okay. Does anybody else have questions? Yes, I do. I'll start with Brett. When you were talking about personal security on your own system, have you ever used the USB authentication key?
You know, I've looked at USB authentication keys like YubiKey, but I haven't really gotten that far. I've been hardening my own system with firewalls. I actually have two firewalls in my home network right now, as well as subnetting it. But YubiKey is something I've definitely been interested in. I haven't delved into that part yet.
Yeah. It's my understanding that it's more secure than MFAs.
Yeah, mine too. And I know it's a big standard for a lot of federal organizations to use authentication keys like that. Yeah. So it has piqued my interest very much.
Yeah,
that
makes sense. Yeah. Great, thank you.
Absolutely.
Shane. I've heard a lot about NordVPN, but I've never used it. Have you ever heard about NordVPN, or which VPN do you recommend in your experience?
I don't really use VPNs for personal stuff. I found that, you know, you only need it really if you want to get different content from different, you know, if you're trying to get a certain show on Netflix and use a VPN to... say you're in Australia or something, but you know, really, the only time to use a VPN is really if you're on like a network that you don't trust, like hotel Wi-Fi or something, and encrypt your traffic so that you know, they can't spy on you. But really, I haven't found a reason to pay for VPN servers just for at home, but some others might have a different view on that.
Yeah, I haven't ever gotten one, but I've heard that they're great for if, like you said, you want to watch Netflix in a different country or something like that.
So, Angela, on that note, one thing that a lot of the antivirus suites come with, like I use, I have a Bitdefender Armor firewall in my system, so I actually have the Bitdefender Total Security that comes with a VPN. That you can use. I know a lot of the companies, depending on again what antivirus you use, they have a VPN where you can get so much data for free. And then if you, of course, we're using it all the time. Again, if you take your laptop and you go and you want to work from, like Shane had said, if you're going to Panera, something like that, or you want to work from public, you're not using, you know, your own hotspots, things like that. And even when you're on your own hotspot, I always use it anyways. But again, I would just check if you used an antivirus and see if it has a VPN attached to it that gives you at least a limited amount.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'm going to be taking a trip to Germany to visit family over Christmas, so I think I want one.
Yeah, and again, even if it gives you a limited amount, I know most of them, you can just pay, you know, you can use an upgrade, you know, directly with theirs, and it works directly with the antivirus, which when it seems to be a crapshoot. I think there's been three or four of the different VPN systems that have had their own troubles over the last few years. So it's, they are what they are. It's going to be a lot better than not having one, but yeah, not being on the public networks is always the safest way to go. But of course you can't always help that.
And don't use a free one.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. No. Don't use a free one. That's what I'm saying. If you're paying for an antivirus software, the free one on there, it's not free. You're paying for that minimal amount. Yeah, the free ones are. Yeah.
You could always, like someone said in chat, you could use like open source and create your own. I have a firewall at home that can have a limited VPN connection, so I use that if I'm going anywhere too. So you could do your homegrown one.
Looks like Carrie has a question.
I was just piggybacking off of the VPN. My husband's Navy, and we lived in Japan for 4 years, and we had to have a VPN to watch Hulu and Netflix and everything. And we used ExpressVPN. I think it was like $4.95 a month or something like that. And it never failed us one time.
Nice. I'll look into that. Yeah, I watch a lot of YouTube tutorials, and they always have Express was one of them, or NordVPN.
Yeah, that was the Express one was the one that we used on base.
Into that. Thanks. I also had a question about the TLS, Shane. Because Marjorie tasked Nate and I to update PGIP's TLS. which version do you use? Do you use 1.3 and above?
I don't really manage servers that often, but I think I'm not really sure on the standards, actually. Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. It was something new to me, and that just caught my eye because I'd never done it before either.
Yeah, I'm just a network guy.
It was interesting to learn that SSL is the old way of saying TLS.
Yep, I knew that.
The same thing.
SSL v3. Yeah. Sorry.
Angela, I think 1.3 and later, or it might be 1.4 for TLS.
Right. I think we ended up doing 1.3 and then a wild card, you know, at least 1.3.
In terms of SSL to TLS, what happened was you have to do a little handshake. You know, with what you're connecting to, so on and so forth. And so there was a vulnerability in that handshake in SSL that took a really, 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 I mean, it was there for a really long time, but it was found. So they changed the handshaking and then they renamed it to TLS for I don't know what reason.
Oh, yeah, it's Transport Layer Protocol? Security
protocol. Yes, yeah. It's just the handshaking that changed, not anything else. So, you know, that's the difference.
Yeah, and 1.4 is the most secure, but most use 1.3 and above, because if you have version 1 to 1.2, it's hard to have that handshake occur if somebody, you know, the client side has a lesser version, is my understanding. And Steven, I was so interested in yours because, like I said, my husband, he's an owner operator in an over-the-road truck driver. So I can see a lot of the GPS things being used in other transfer, domestic transfer places. And I hope that the DOT or even the company he's leased to don't learn that you guys can track container doors when they're open and shut, because then that'll be just a nightmare. Oh, his trailer door's open. He must be at the place. I can see you're unmuted, but I don't hear you.
Now can you hear me?
Oh, there you go. I can hear you now.
It's a stupid button on my headset.
Yeah. So you deal with the container, the GPS on the containers, right?
Yeah, I just started dealing with the containers and the chassis coming from the ports, mainly from California and up in New Jersey. I'm dealing with 40,000 GPS units, and then the whole fleet is 100,000 trailers and chassis and containers together, which is
wow.
It's 95,000 more devices than I've ever touched in my life. So.
Wow. Yeah, I bet. Wow, that's a lot. So yeah, all. that's very interesting. I like that. Thanks for sharing that.
Yep. Absolutely.
And Dr. R, did you have any questions for Nick? I'm sorry, Jason. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Stephen. I deal with a few GPSs in my job, but how do you keep them from being tampered with? Because I know they have to be on the outside of whatever you're using.
That is something that will probably never be solved.
Okay.
Huh. I've always said, dealing with GPS tracking for the past 18 years, you can't really hide a GPS unit on something that is outside.
Yeah, if you want it to work.
Yeah, if you want it to work, it's easy to hide it inside a vehicle under a dashboard. But a trailer and a chassis, it's outside in the elements, and it's metal. So, and metal blocks the signal. So, and a thief with a sledgehammer can smash it off a trailer in 2 minutes.
Yeah. Trying to think of how to fix that problem.
If there's a will, there's a way.
I was going to say, at that point, it's just a matter of having an alert when it goes offline that says, hey, this is where it went offline when, and you have to do a miles and time correlation as far as where it could possibly be from there.
Pretty much.
Yeah, look at all the Wi-Fi scooters out there that you can rent. They all have trackers on them, too.
Yep, exactly.
Everybody get your protractors out.
That's right. Get your compass.
Your compass. We're gonna make a little circle here. They gotta be within this radius.
We're gonna do a little CSI.
Everybody Nick, here knows what a map is, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Not Google.
We know
maps.
How to read them anymore.
Like a piece of paper we lay out. Okay.
Nick, yeah. You said you worked a lot with compliance with those audits.
Yes.
Have you and Fallon gotten together? Have you kind of taken her under your wing?
I have not, mainly because I have not really had a whole lot of extra time.
Okay, yeah, understandable.
She's a lot further along in like the GRC stuff than I am.
Okay.
Because yeah. I'm working compliance, I'm also working on a few different company. I'm working with Sophos and going through the Palo Alto certified network engineer training as well. So doing both of those has kind of put a little bit hindrance on my compliance training, but actually I'm.
So maybe she should take you under her wing.
maybe that's what I told her. I was like, maybe when you're done, I'll have to get with you and you can give me a study guide run through on the GRC stuff. Cause I'd like to know that. I'm kind of looking at a focus towards the engineering side, but I definitely enjoy the compliance side. So
right. It was interesting to me. I had to do a little research on it to try and give her a task when she was in our department. And yeah, it's interesting. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I did have a conversation. Her and I went back and forth for, I think, about an hour or so for a while. Just kind of, she was letting me know where she was at and kind of discussing. I was kind of giving her some ideas. And, of course, some of the paths to take, but yeah, I think she's probably going to be a lot further along than I am as far as, you know, GRC compliance by the time we're done. So yeah, I'll definitely have to hit her up on that. She seems to be flying through that pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. It's interesting. I like it. Does anybody else have any questions for anybody? Dr. R, did you want to talk about a little bit about the presentation that you're
for next Tuesday?
Yeah, for next Tuesday.
Oh, sure. Okay. So I teach the capstone for the Masters of Science in Cybersecurity. And so I have two students that are going to present live. and that will be next Tuesday night between 7 and 8 p.m. And I'll be getting that information to Marjorie or you, Angela. And we'd love for our interns to come listen to the live presentations. This will be the first time that we've done this. Usually what I do in place of this is they do a presentation that is not audio narrated. And so that kind of simulates a live presentation. But yeah, so you guys are invited and I hope you come.
Yeah, if you get me the link and some of the specifications, I can put it in the announcements, our announcements chat where everybody can see it.
Very good. I should have that tomorrow. I'm waiting for one student's tossing around different titles for his presentation. So I should have everything ready tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Just shoot me the link and... It was at 7 p.m.
8 p.m.
8 p.m. Okay.
Next Tuesday night. Yep. Thank you. Right. Mm-hmm. And good job, everybody.
Yeah, you guys did great. I really enjoyed it. So,
I just wanted to say great job, everyone, too. I was here listening to all of that. I always learn a lot from this group. It's scary. But thanks, everyone.
Yep, you guys all did a great job. I really enjoyed it. So thank you to Brett, Shane, Steven, Nick, and Jason. And if that is all, no further questions, I'll let you guys all enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thanks so much.
Good night.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Bye, guys.